This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogaeus, sitting in for Terry Gross. Whenever you see a big crowd huddled around an exhibit in the ancient Egypt section of a museum, you can be sure what they're staring at. The mummies. Our guest today, Bob Breyer, is one of the world's leading authorities on mummies. Breyer is an Egyptologist specializing in paleopathology, which is the study of the diseases of the ancient world. He teaches at CW Post campus of Long Island University. Breyer made headlines in 1994 when he mummified a modern human cadaver using the techniques ancient embalmers applied in mummifying the pharaohs. Bob Breyer is the author of several books on mummies and ancient Egypt. He's also the host of The Great Egyptians, a television series on the Learning Channel. In his new book, The Murder of Tutankhamun, Breyer uses modern forensic evidence from King Tut's remains to bolster his theory that the young pharaoh did not meet a natural end. I asked Bob Breyer what makes him think there was foul play.
To tell you the truth, Barbara, the evidence is from different areas, and it's not as strong as we'd like it, but it really suggests murder. The forensic stuff, when I finally got into it, wasn't my strongest evidence. Sure, there's evidence of a blow to the back of the head, but that's not murder. A bullet to the brain is not murder. It could be an accident. It could be all kinds of things. You have to look at the circumstantial evidence. And it's the circumstantial stuff that really got me going, and I think in some ways is very moving and what makes it a great story. For example, soon after Tutankhamun died, his widow, who was the last member of the royal family, wrote a letter to the king of the Hittites. Now, the Hittites were the traditional enemies of ancient Egypt. And she writes a letter to the Hittite king and says, "My husband has died. Sons I have none. They say to thee, thy sons are many. Send me one of thine sons, and I will make him king of Egypt. Never will I marry a servant of mine. I am afraid." Now, that's pretty impressive stuff. Why is the queen of Egypt writing to the Hittite king and saying she's afraid? And why is she saying, "I'll marry one of your sons and make him king of Egypt"? You know, aren't there eligible Egyptians around? So I think that suggests at least that some strange things are going on during the time, and that it's turmoil.
Is there any other circumstantial evidence?
Oh, there's plenty. For example, the prince eventually was sent from the land of the Hittites. The king at first didn't believe it. It was so incredible that he sent a messenger to Egypt to make sure the story was true. Messenger came back, said, "Yep, it's true." And then finally the prince was sent. But we know from the Hittite records that the prince was murdered by Egyptians on the border of Egypt. Right? So there is at least one documented murder. Then the question becomes, well, who murdered the prince and why? And who was this servant that she didn't want to marry? Well, the next thing we know is that Tutankhamun is buried. And when his tomb was discovered in 1922, that was the first time we knew with absolute certainty who his successor was, who followed Tutankhamun. On the walls of the tomb is a painting of Tutankhamun as a mummy. And next to him is the next pharaoh. We're sure he's the pharaoh because he's wearing the crown of the king. And he's administering the equivalent of the last rites to Tutankhamun. That is, he's holding an instrument to the mouth. The opening of the mouth ceremony is being performed. And the pharaoh is going to be given breath and life in the next world. And this next king is Aye, who was the vizier of Egypt at the time. So he was an old, trusted servant. Now the question becomes, how did I, a commoner, become king of Egypt? And now you're supposed to ask, what's the next clue?
Go on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an amazing story, but it's all true, which is neat. The next clue is a ring, a faience, a ceramic ring, that was found in an antiquity dealer's shop in Cairo in the 1930s. It was found by Percy Newberry, an Egyptologist who used to rummage through these stores looking for interesting historical objects. The ring has the cartouches, the ovals that encircle royal names, of two royal people. One is Ankhesenamun, the widow of Tutankhamun, and the other is Aye, the vizier. And what it means is that Aye married Ankhesenamun. Aye married the widow. So the way Aye became pharaoh was by marrying this terrified widow who's saying, "Never shall I marry a servant, i.e. commoner. I am afraid."
Well, that's a nasty story. The regent kills the king and marries his wife.
That part is fairly well documented. What isn't documented is what happens to Ankhesenamun next. She disappears from history. We don't have her tomb. We don't have any record of her after this. The last record we have is this frantic letter written saying, "I am afraid."
Back to the forensics. What exactly remains of a mummy? What remained of King Tut in mummy form? I understand you have to remove the brain and the internal organs to mummify a body. So what did you have left to go on? What were you looking at?
With mummies, it varies with the individual mummy as to how much remains. If it's been well preserved, there's not just a skeleton, but there's also soft tissue. But part of the embalming was removal of the internal organs. They were taken out through an incision in the left side of the abdomen, but kept. They were placed in special jars called canopic jars. And these jars were used to preserve the organs because the Egyptians were resurrectionists. They believed that in the next world, you would get up and go again. You would literally get up and go again. So they kept everything, except the brain. The brain was removed through the nose, but that was thrown out. Now, the reason, you might say, well, why didn't they keep the brain? Because you wanted to get up and go again. You're going to need your brain. The Egyptians believed that you thought with your heart, which is not a crazy theory. I mean, for example, when you get excited, it's your heart that beats quickly, not your brain. So the brain is thrown out. But with Tutankhamun, we have the skeleton, and we still have his internal organs. They were kept. Now, unfortunately, when he was examined carefully in the 1920s, when the tomb was first discovered, there wasn't much in the way of advanced technology for what to do with these things. So one of my hopes is to examine, for example, the organs. From examining his stomach, we can tell what was his last meal. Did he eat way before he died, or was it right after a meal? We might be able to tell by examining his liver, was he sick? Did he linger for a long time before dying? So there are lots of things we can go on from Tutankhamun. We just have to get access to the body.
Did you actually study his mummy?
No. His mummy is sealed in the tomb where it was found. The body of Tutankhamun is the only one left in the Valley of the Kings of the pharaohs because he was found in his tomb virtually intact. It was thought that after the treasures were removed and the body was examined, it should stay in the tomb. So it's still there in the sarcophagus, sealed in. One of the interesting things I did examine were two fetuses, mummified fetuses, that were found in the tomb with Tutankhamun. These were probably miscarriages of his young wife, Ankhesenamun. And if either of those two little girls had lived, history would have been quite different. There would have been a successor.
How was your murder theory received by other Egyptologists?
Well, I think it's really mixed in a funny way. It's far from proven that he was murdered. It really is a theory, as you say. I think it's a reasonable theory, and I think it's probably the most reasonable theory. But I had some interesting responses from colleagues. One really sticks in my mind. I had done this television show about the murder of Tutankhamun for the Learning Channel, and it got a lot of publicity and very good reviews, received very well. But being received very well on television isn't the same as having a solid academic, theory. And I got a letter from a very close colleague. I mean, she's very close, a dear friend, saying, basically, Bob, you got it all wrong. I was a grandfather type who really always nurtured the young couple, and he never would have killed Tut. Now, that's her position, which I certainly respect. But what was interesting was that I think she felt that her theory had more, perhaps, support, but I don't think it really did. I think these things become very personal, and we become perhaps too attached to our theories. And if evidence crops up that contradicts your theory, you give it up.
Dr. Bob Breyer is my guest. He's an Egyptologist specializing in paleopathology, which is the study of diseases of the ancient world. He's conducted autopsies on many ancient mummies. He's written 4 books about ancient Egypt. His new book is The Murder of Tutankhamun. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Egyptologist Bob Breyer. He's a leading authority on mummies and the diseases of the ancient world. He hosts the TV series The Great Egyptians on the Learning Channel. Part 2 airs the beginning of May. A couple of years ago, you mummified a modern human cadaver yourself in the manner of the ancient Egyptians. First of all, how did you get permission to do this?
Oh, in any medical project involving a human cadaver, there is usually a state board that determines what is done with the cadavers. So you write up your proposal, like any grant proposal, explaining what your goals are, why you're doing it, and then they either approve it or turn it down. So ours was unanimously approved.
Who was the lucky cadaver?
I'm not going to tell you. Whenever a body is given to science, there's always the condition of anonymity. So we don't reveal who it was, and the person who gave his body to science doesn't know what the project is going to be for which his body will be used. So he's going to be surprised when he wakes up and finds himself mummified.
What did you hope to learn by doing it yourself?
Well, before we did the project, the general procedures for mummification were known. The crucial thing is to dehydrate the body, because bacteria need moisture to work on a body. That is, they won't attack a body unless there's moisture there. This is why, for example, the blueberries, the dehydrated blueberries in your cereal last so long. So we knew that they dehydrated, basically. They removed the internal organs. But there were lots of details that we really didn't know. For example, how do you remove a brain through the nose? Or is it possible to remove the liver through a 2.5-inch incision, which is all they made in the abdomen? Or, for example, how much natron, which is the desiccant they use, the white powder that occurs in Egypt, how much natron do you need to dehydrate a human cadaver? So there were a lot of questions that we wanted to answer, and that's why we attempted a mummification.
And did you find your answers?
Yeah, it was rather successful. And I don't mean to hedge by rather. It was really quite successful. For example, it takes 600 pounds of natron to dehydrate a body. Or one of the things we were interested in was how do you take the brain out through the nose? It was very difficult is the answer. It didn't happen the way most of us thought it did. That is, we all thought, and there are papers written on it, which we now know are wrong, that the body's lying on its back, and with a long tube, you probe through the nasal passage, past the ethmoid bone, which is the bone behind your eyes, and then into the cranium. And then what you do is with a kind of long hooked instrument, very much like a coat hanger, you pull a little bit of the brain out, a little bit at a time, and repeat this many times, and then you get the brain out. Wrong. Doesn't happen that way. We tried it. The brain is not viscous enough. It just doesn't adhere to the coat hanger instrument and doesn't come out. What we finally realized was you use the instrument kind of like a whisk, and you rotate it inside the cranium so that you break down the brain till it's almost in a liquid state, and then you turn the cadaver upside down, and the brain runs out through the nose.
Oh, man. How much?
Not for everybody.
How good a job did you do on your mummy? Where is he or she?
It's a he. I think we did really well. The mummy is, as I put it, dead and well. It was mummified about 2.5 years ago. And since that time, it's remained at room temperature with no preservatives other than its dehydration. And it has no signs of decaying anymore. So we think we've really done it right. The mummy, as a matter of fact, just made its first trip. It's out in San Diego, California, at the Museum of Man, where they're having a very large exhibition on mummies, and they're bringing in mummies from Peru and the Bog mummies and Egyptian mummies, and they wanted our thoroughly modern mummy.
Why did the ancient Egyptians first begin mummifying bodies?
Well, it comes from the religion. They were resurrectionists. They believed the body would literally get up and go again in the next world, so you had to have your body. And it had to be intact. I think originally, the first embalmer was really the sands of Egypt. In very early historic times, they buried the bodies in a sand pit. And if you bury a body in warm, dry sand, it'll dehydrate very quickly. And this is what preserved the body and created natural mummies. And I think this was the idea from which the Egyptians went. You know, if you see it, I mean, at some point, the sand is going to blow away from the mummy, and it's going to be exposed. And you're looking at a human being who hasn't changed that much, who may have died 200-300 years ago. And I think this may have given rise to the Egyptian theory of resurrection, that nothing really changes when you die. You just go to a different place.
Bob Breer is my guest. He's a leading Egyptologist and a mummy expert. He teaches philosophy at CW Post University. Your specialty is diseases of ancient peoples, and that's what you're looking at often when you're studying mummies. What did ancient Egyptians suffer from?
Well, one of the things we get from studying mummies is a picture of what they suffered from, and the answer is almost everything. The ancient Egyptians were always sick. It's easy to form this picture of this happy civilization on the banks of the Nile. You know, they were the greatest civilization of their time in the Near East, but they were sick all the time. One of the things we learn is that they had a lot of intestinal parasites. Whenever we look at the abdominal cavity, you'll see larvae, you'll see remains of parasites. So they had things like anemia all the time. Another thing that they really had problems with and must have caused tremendous discomfort was tooth decay. And it wasn't tooth decay in our sense. They didn't have sugar. So they weren't getting cavities the way we do in modern society. They were getting cavities from their daily bread. Their bread was stone ground. And what that means is when you're grinding it, you're getting a little bit of your stone in your bread. Not only that, but then you had wind-blown sand coming into the bread. So when they ate their bread, they were actually grinding down their teeth. And almost all Egyptians had ground down teeth, which eventually exposes the roots and causes a lot of pain. So there were a lot of Egyptians who were really unhappy campers.
I think there were pharaohs who you surmise died of tooth abscesses.
Well, Ramses the Great actually may have died of an abscess on the mandible, the lower jaw. There's a really big abscess and a hole. He could have died of septic infection from that. And even the pharaoh Amenhotep III had terrible teeth, and he may not have been able to rule for the last couple of years. He may have had to have been sedated, perhaps with wine, maybe even with opium, which was the new miracle drug of the new kingdom. So teeth were a significant part of the daily life of the Egyptians, and it wasn't a pleasant part.
What do you learn about modern diseases studying ancient ones?
The idea of studying ancient diseases is that if we understand what happened in the old world, in ancient times, and if we see the progression of the disease into modern times, we'll know more about the modern state of the disease. For example, one of the things I'm interested in is Alzheimer's. Is Alzheimer's a purely modern disease, or did it occur in ancient Egypt? Now, it's hard to study because usually the Egyptians remove the brain at mummification and you need to study brains. But there are some lower-priced mummifications where the brains remain inside the crania. So what we've got to do is study brains of old ancient Egyptians and see if there's any evidence of Alzheimer's. And I've been doing that. So far, we have no evidence of Alzheimer's yet, and it may be a modern disease. If it is, we'll have learned something, that it's something about the living conditions today that made it appear, and then we may be on the track of how to prevent it.
How about cancer? Did ancient Egyptians suffer from cancer?
Cancer is an interesting question. There's a bit of a debate among paleopathologists now whether there was any cancer in ancient Egypt. We don't have real, solid, absolute, certain evidence of soft tissue cancer. There's some bone cancer, lesions on the bone, that seems to be pretty solid. But soft tissue cancer, we don't seem to have it any real evidence. There's a couple of things that look like it. But it's interesting. If they didn't suffer from cancer, that would be really interesting. One of the things they did suffer from, which I think is surprising, is hardening of the arteries, arteriosclerosis. You know, normally it's the kind of thing that we attribute to our living, our fatty diets and our sedentary ways and this kind of thing. But a lot of mummies show arteriosclerosis. There's a clogging of the arteries. Ramses the Great had it, but Ramses lived till he was 86 or so. But that's one of the surprises.
I have to ask you the have you ever actually touched a mummy question and what it feels like.
Oh, I've touched lots of mummies, and it feels just fine. Mummies are fairly solid. One of the things that people don't realize is they're very light. An average mummy weighs about 30 pounds because once you dehydrate it, remember, we're mostly water, and once you take out the water, we don't weigh very much. So mummies are very light, certainly hard. There's no sense of softness of tissue. And I think one of the things you have to be careful with, they're really quite brittle, quite fragile. Over 2,000-3,000 years, the bone structure gets very, very friable, very fragile. So you have to be very careful.
Were you always a mummy fan as a child?
Oh, yeah. I think I always liked mummy movies, always was interested in things like that. So I think it's almost a childhood fantasy come true.
Bob Breyer's new book is The Murder of Tutankhamun. He hosts The Great Egyptians, a six-hour TV series on the Learning Channel. Part 2 airs Sunday, May 3rd. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.